You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Remember the $6 million man and the Bionic Woman TV series where the hero's powers were heightened with mechanical body parts? Well, today, advances in robotics, genetics, and nanotechnology are bringing science fiction scenarios such as these into the realm of the reality. Scientists have taught monkeys to move a robotic arm using only brain signals. That means perhaps one day paralyzed people fitted with electrodes in their brains, who knows, they might be able to do the same, which we, you know, would blend the boundary between humans and machines, science and science fictions. And there, you know, there's a new drug out now on the market that treats short stature in kids by replacing a hormone they're missing. Should drugs that make us smarter or boost our muscle mass or make us live longer be allowed too? What's in store there? Pregnant women today can undergo prenatal testing for a host of genetic diseases, with the option of terminating a pregnancy if a disability is discovered. And while few would argue that preventing debilitating diseases isn't a worthy goal, what if it doesn't stop there? What if parents can someday select for characteristics such as intelligence, height, or gender, and perhaps not by terminating a pregnancy, but perhaps by genetic engineering? So for the rest of the hour, we'll be talking about the advances in medicine and technology that may someday allow us to be better, stronger, faster, and maybe even disease-free. But of course, with that future comes also these questions. Do these advances also change what it means to be human? And who will be left behind in our quest for perfection? Probably people who can't afford to get those kinds of treatments. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Joel Garrow is the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. It's out this year, published in Doubleday. He's a reporter and editor at the Washington Post, where he covers a cultural revolution. And he joins us today from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Ira.
Hi there. Joan Rothschild is the author of The Dream of the Perfect Child, published this year by the Indiana University Press. She's a professor emerita of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, a research associate at the Center for Human Environments and the Graduate Center at City University in New York, and she joins us here today in our Science Friday studios in New York. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rothschild.
Thank you.
Now, let me begin with you. One application of genetic technology, and I mentioned this in my introduction, is the quest to create a perfect child. Do we all know what a perfect child is, or do each of us have a different idea of what that might be?
Well, I think that what's happening is we really, the perfect child is a perfect child by default. In other words, that we, through testing, we can find out certain conditions that a fetus may have. I don't like to use disability or defect. They're such loaded words. And by those criteria, we know what we don't want. And by default, really, we're talking about what we might want. Mm-hmm. We also do know that when there is sperm selection, when people are trying to get a sperm donor, they do actually ask for specific characteristics, and that's where we get into what people want.
They have these Mensa people giving up. I've read about these groups,
really?
And clubs, yeah. So we're not talking about just healthy now in this brave new world. We're talking about intelligence and maybe hair color, things like that.
Yeah, well, there's a difference between, for example, hair color and physical characteristics you might be able to match for in a sperm donor to some extent. But when you start getting intelligence, that becomes a little. One person at a sperm bank in Boston that I talked to on the phone, she said, "Oh, we don't have any trouble with that because they're all graduate students and medical students," and she couldn't see my face for laughing. So, I mean, you really can't really predict that.
Mm-hmm. Joel, let's talk about, you say we're in a unique time in history when these technologies are aimed inward instead of outward. What do you mean by that? That we're trying to create better people from the inside?
Well, Ira, for hundreds of thousands of years, our technologies have been aimed outward at modifying our environment in the fashion of fire and clothes, agriculture, cities, space travel. Now they're increasingly aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, our kids, and what it means to be human.
Why do you think we've changed that way? That, you know, instead of reaching for the stars, we're reaching for the gallbladder or something like that. Why?
Well, we're going through an unprecedented time in our technology. We've got a curve of increasing change that's been going on since the 60s, known as Moore's Law. This is the idea that computer power has been doubling every 18 months since the chip was first invented in 1959. This means we've seen an increase of over 400 million times in the amount of power you can buy for a dollar. And this is opening up entirely new vistas in completely different areas, like genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnology, what I call the grin technologies. And these are all aimed at changing what it means to be human. For example, you're going to have a kid coming home in tears in the very near future because he can't compete with the other kids in school who are more athletic, smarter, better behaved, more beautiful, more capable, better able to get into college. And the reason for this is that their parents have invested in these enhancements, which are coming at us at ever-increasing frequency, and you haven't.
What kind of enhancements are you talking about?
We're talking about everything. I mean, take, for example, the second grade daughter whose hand you're holding now. Flash forward 15 years to the time that she's coming back from law school for the first time. If the stuff that's in the labs right now, I mean right now, turns out to work, her friends are going to have, in law school, are going to have amazing thinking abilities. They'll be not only faster and more creative than anybody she's ever met, but faster and more creative than anybody she's ever imagined. They'll have photographic memories,
recall. And how will they get this? Are we going to genetically modify the brains of these kids, or are we going to select the eggs, or what?
No, there's a variety. There are these four technologies, one of which is robotics, which means blurring the distinction between the made and the born. Mm-hmm. It's right now there are a guy up in Boston named Matthew Nagel, who is the fellow who is the first human to be able to send an email with his thoughts. And he's able to control a robotic arm long distance. This is military technology that was originally designed to help pilots fly an F-22 because it's very difficult to fly one of these aircraft with a joystick. How much better it would be, the people at DARPA think. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is the R&D arm of the Pentagon. How much better it would be if there was a direct mind-to-machine connection between the pilot and the plane, and also the plane could feed back directly into your brain without benefit of screen or keyboard, so that whatever it senses, you'll be able to see and feel. And this is not just military. Michael Goldblatt, who is in charge of this research, he has a daughter named Gina Marie, who's a very talented young lady at the University of Arizona, but she has cerebral palsy. And he's very upfront about the fact that he's been spending millions of taxpayer dollars to get her out of her wheelchair. Because if you can have a direct connection between mind and machine, there's no reason why those machines couldn't be in Gina Marie's legs. And this would mean disabilities would be as difficult to detect as whatever a person's original hair color might be.
Mm-hmm. Joan, you've been shaking your head here.
Well, I'm just wondering if that can really happen that soon. I'm somewhat skeptical about the fact that we would go that far. And it also would be to a very small part of the population. I guess in my book, I'm really talking about something that's happening much more widespread. And because testing is there, the doctors, the gatekeepers, are trying to have every pregnant woman tested. And my research is much more in the United States, but there it's true. And even now, poorer women are getting tested. And
you mean prenatal testing?
Yeah.
And you think we can get there by the prenatal testing route?
No. Well, no, I'm saying that the prenatal testing that we have is no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that I don't know whether what we are doing now is trying to find genes and for particular diseases and particular conditions, and I don't see us getting to the next area. In other words, that of really a genetic enhancement for a very, very long time, and it would only be for a really very select group of people. That's really what I'm saying.
But Joel, I think, is talking about mechanical enhancement in some of these things. Right, Joel?
Yes. That's true. Genetics is only one of these technologies.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we're missing is this curve of accelerated change.
Uh-huh.
I mean, when you're seeing the doubling of these technologies, and not just computers, but genetics. I mean, genetics, we thought that we wouldn't sequence the human genome until the year 2015 at a cost of untold billions. And yet, of course, it happened in 2001 at a fraction of the price. Why? Because you're seeing this repeated doubling of technological capabilities. And what that means is that the last 20 years, by this arithmetic, is not a guide to the next 20 years. It's a guide to the next 8. And then that last 50 years is not a guide to the next 50 years. It's a guide to the next 14. The idea that the future is going to be a linear progression from the past is, I think, an old idea that we can no longer deal with.
But we are, if you think that we're going to be moving in this direction in the next few years and your kids are going to come home, you know, being more athletically enabled, we're seeing, if you look at what's going on with the drugs in baseball, we're seeing a backlash against that idea.
Well, there are three scenarios as to how this might work out. By the way, I don't make any predictions in radical evolution. Mm-hmm. I'm a reporter. I'm just talking about what's in the lab right now, mm-hmm. what's being funded right now, and I'm talking about what happens to our society and values when this stuff begins to work, as it already is. For example, within 3 years, we should have memory pills on the market. There are 5 U.S. companies now in stage 2 clinical trials, and this will do wonders to people with Alzheimer's, but it should also be a commercial blockbuster. Because, I mean, think of all the baby boomers who are going to want to banish their senior moments. I mean, me for one.
We don't know if they work yet. They could be in clinical trials, but we don't know if they work yet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, alas, but when we're looking at thousands of procedures and thousands of researchers, all of whom are aimed at this in the same direction, which is to fundamentally change the capabilities of what it means to be human, I think we have to ask, well, what happens if some portion of this works? And that's when you get into the three scenarios of heaven, hell, and prevail. Mm-hmm. The heaven scenario is the one that researchers say, hey, look, we're talking about banishing ignorance, stupidity, ugliness, and even death. They see this curve going straight up, and they see that their version of it is that within 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to be seeing astonishing changes that are essentially indistinguishable from the Christian version of heaven, and they think that's just great. But, of course, there's also the reverse possibility. There are other researchers who say, the power that we are unleashing here, what happens if this gets into the hands of maniacs or even bumblers? I mean, there was the case of the Australian mousepox incident, where Australian researchers were trying to make a contraceptive for mice, because this is a creatures that just run amok in Australia, and they made one genetic change, and they created a monster. All of a sudden, they had a virus that was 100% fatal to mice. And then they put their research on the internet, where anybody with a reasonably well-equipped biology lab could replicate it. And mousepox is not fatal to humans, but it's a very close relative to smallpox, which obviously is. And, I mean, what happens if someone just begins to copy this technology? This is where the optimistic version of the hell scenario is one in which we wipe out the human species in the next 25 years or earlier.
All
that's
right,
the optimistic version.
Let me give
the pessimistic version is the one in which we wipe out all of life on Earth.
We hate when that happens. We're talking this hour about the future on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Joel Garrow, author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Joan Rothschild, author of The Dream of the Perfect Child, published by Indiana University Press. Joan, you've been listening. What do you think?
Well, I can't predict, as Joel Garrow has, about how fast this is happening. It certainly is happening fast. But I think to project ahead that these things really are going to happen and they're going to happen that fast, and that the people in the laboratories are trying to are talking about what's making us human. I think that there's a lot of other research going on which is trying to get at genetic disease and so on, and I'm really questioning where our resources are, where we're putting all our resources to, not to all our resources, but to some of the resources. And I mean, that's sort of his agenda, but the thing that I'm talking about is what's happening in the real world. That in the real world, in reproductive medical practice, people are making decisions about which children are acceptable and which are not. And that's happening real. That's happening right now. And I think that when we have to look at reproductive medical practice, we do have the tools now. Yes, we have the genetics and the technologies to do some of this. And in hundreds and thousands of doctors' offices throughout the country, the doctor, the genetic counselor, and the parents who very much want this are making decisions, and these aggregate and they add up to the children we don't want and, by default, the children we might want. The sex selection is a very good example of your template. It's the dividing line. Mm-hmm. It's testing to find out the sex for non-medical reasons. All of the other tests are medical. This is social. The others are social in their own way, social right. and cultural. But these are social. And so this is the kind of thing that's happening, and we should look at that kind of thing, of decisions that are being made on social reasons, and then we get into some of the scenarios that Joel was talking about. But I think we get through it through medical practice, through reproductive medical practice, that's happening right now.
It's happening all over the world, and
yes.
even accelerated outside of the U.S.
That's right.
In other countries.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there are countries.
I've got about 30 seconds. Other, go ahead.
There are countries with other ethical systems than ours mm-hmm. that are farther ahead in this, in a lot of these technologies. I mean, the first genetic therapy to be licensed came out of China. Mm-hmm. The first cloned human embryos came out of South Korea. Mm-hmm. India has, as its stated governmental goal, to try to leapfrog the West in all of these technologies in order to bring them into development ahead of us faster.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Joel Garrow. He's author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Joan Rothschild, author of The Dream of the Perfect Child. And we'll come back after this short break. Take your questions. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about engineering better humans, if that's possible, with my guest Joan Rothschild, author of The Dream of the Perfect Child, and Joel Garrow, author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Joan, how does... Give me an idea first of how many pregnant women are being offered these prenatal tests. Is this a large percentage or just...
In the United States, women who are called older mothers, advanced maternal age, 35 and over, are definitely offered. Others who are they're considered high risk. Others high risk who have given birth to a child, for example, with spina bifida. But now, in many places, most women, an awful lot of women, particularly in California and in New York State, we don't have national statistics. In this country, you have more and more programs where poorer women who are not white and middle class or upper class, are being offered it. I don't have the actual numbers. In fact, it's almost impossible to get those numbers in the United States without a national health care system. Different topic is right. Okay. So that it is becoming more and more, and let me make the distinction, this screening, the triple screen and now the quadruple screen, which is testing the mother's blood for an indication function, and then you go to ultrasound and amnio if there is something. So there's a distinction between a screen, which is not diagnostic, but merely gives you some idea of a that there may be something wrong, and then you go to a more to testing, to actual diagnosing. So there is a difference there. So then the numbers become much, much smaller. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And having this, let's call it a tool, the prenatal testing. How does that change the way a woman experiences a pregnancy?
Well, I can give a plug to another book that came out 15 years ago by Barbara Katz Rothman called The Tentative Pregnancy, and she did a beautiful job, and it's still there, and you find it in the literature, that particularly when amnio was in the by about the fourth month, in other words, the middle of the pregnancy, a woman really just couldn't experience her pregnancy without doubt before she had some kind of assurance, mm-hmm. that there that the child might be okay, or that isn't even a guarantee. Whereas, and that still continues. So that it's very trying for women. The testing is now done much more in the first trimester, which does change the view as to whether a woman will carry the pregnancy to term or not, because the abortion is, and by the way, there are really only two choices. There's a choice to terminate the pregnancy or to continue it. There are really no cures, and I think what your first interview did today talked about that, the fact that we really know very little. We've only isolated single gene disorders. We have not isolated other kinds of conditions where they're multifactorial. So so we have a long way to go.
Joel, how close are we to doing any kind of genetic engineering, prenatal genetic engineering?
As I know, it's not. It would have to be done though in the petri dish. In other words, it would have to be done there. And right now, that is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is only to diagnose for a particular condition. So as far as I know, we are not doing it.
Joel, is this one of the things that your folks that you've been looking at are working on?
Well, there's a company called Functional Genetics, and one of the founders of this is Stanley Cohen, who is the guy who basically invented recombinant DNA. Mm-hmm. And they've got a proprietary system that works in pigs right now, in which you attack viruses like AIDS or avian flu in ways that are completely different from the way that medicine has done this up until now. In the past, we've aimed at the virus or at the infectious agent. Now they're talking about turning genes on and off so that the virus can't hijack the machinery of the host. Now, this has already begun to work in pigs, and the question is how quickly we're going to need to start accelerating this sort of research in the face of pandemics like the avian flu. Mm-hmm. This is work that is being funded in a big way and is going commercial. This is at the venture capital stage. I mean, this is not some kind of science fiction. It's like the work that Renat Neurosciences is doing in California to come up with a vaccine against pain. Again, they're approaching the initial public offering stage. This is not science fiction. It's like the pharmaceutical industry that expects half of all new pharmaceuticals by 2010 to come out of genetic research. This is all stuff that's happening in the here and now and accelerating.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Michael in Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Michael.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of genetic enhancing is wonderful, perhaps even the future evolution of man. I do have a concern, though. The subject reminds me of a sci-fi movie I saw in the late 90s called Gattaca. And in this movie, potential parents could choose the exact specifics of their children, including like intelligence, eye color, hair color, physical structure, longevity, etc. And through this, it created a much better human being, but it also created a new kind of segregation between humans that could afford and those that couldn't. The job force in the movie actually required your genetic data entering the workforce, and potential employees either were tagged valid or invalid. And I'm just wondering, given this, that it could cause a new kind of human segregation, would this be something that would be available to all people or just the wealthy?
Joel, you talk about this in your book.
Well, Gattaca is a good example of the hell scenario. in which, you know, now remember that genetic selection has been going on for hundreds of thousands of years in every bar on every Saturday night on this planet. We've been doing this for a long time. All we're talking about doing is adding some precision to this matter. Now the thing about Gattaca, if you're talking about eliminating Tay-Sachs or sickle cell anemia, I'm hard pressed to be against that. But Gattaca imagines that everybody becomes blonde, blue-eyed, and 6 feet tall. That would really be a bummer. That's why I'm interested in the prevail scenario, which is neither heaven nor hell. Scenarios are based on the notion that our future is determined by technology. There's not much we can do about it. Hang on tight. The end. I mean, it would make a great summer blockbuster movie with terrific special effects, but not much plot. Prevail, on the other hand, is the third scenario, and that's based on the notion that the way our future should evolve is one in which we focus not on how many transistors we get to talk to each other, but how many creative, unpredictable, cussed humans we get to connect up. An example of this is the Prevail scenario is what happened during the Dark Ages. I mean, in the 1300s, when the plague was spreading, you might have assumed that the species was really cooked. But all of a sudden, you had the rise of the printing press, which allowed us to store, gather, and spread around ideas in ways that had never been possible before.
Well, but I think what Michael is talking about, and I'll just speak for Michael, he's still on the line, is if you get to this point, who was, and the kind of racism he's talking about is the racism of people who can afford to select these things and go through the medical hoops and paperwork right. that it's required
right.
here.
Yeah. Right. Well, there is a hell scenario here in which you could end up in the very near future with three different kinds of humans: the enhanced who embrace all of these technologies enhancements, the naturals who could do it but who choose not to, like today's vegetarians, and the rest, which are the people who, for reasons of geography or money, don't have access to these technologies and envy and despise those who do. But the thing is, that's not the only scenario. These technologies are getting out to the third world and to the poor vastly quicker than did other technologies like refrigeration or radio or television or cars. I mean, already you can see that this curve of accelerating change means the price keeps on dropping in half on a regular basis. So in Africa, for example, you've got 30 nations now with more cell phones than they have landlines. And in the Philippines, in the year 2000 and 2001, there was a terrible tyrant by the name of Joseph Estrada who was basically run out of town by people who were using their cell phones as to text message in ways that brought hundreds of thousands of people into the street.
Well, but a $20 cell phone is a little bit different than a $10,000 genetic procedure, or more.
No, it isn't.
Well, for the
person, information is information.
It certainly is, but information is cheap, and operations are expensive.
The first genetic sequencing of a human being costs $12 billion. It's not going to be long before that price comes down to $1,000 and then $100, because it's essentially information processing.
Joan, you want to jump in?
No. This is not like heart transplant. Heart transplants never got cheap, because hearts never got plentiful.
The point is that you are, I think that in your book, you talk about Robert Silver's book, Remaking Eden, and that's another hell scenario where you have projects it many generations further, where you will have the haves and the have-nots. He calls it the gen-rich and the gens and the naturals, or whatever he calls them. That's not important. The point is that I think that that will happen, and if we talk about extending technology, we have medical technology. What about AIDS? What about all of the of family planning and all of those kinds of things, which are not particularly, cures for them or being able to deal with them, are not reaching the third world. And I think that those are the kinds of things that we do have to concentrate on. And to get back to Michael's question, I think that Gattaca was a terrible movie. I just saw the video of it. I hadn't seen it, and somebody gave me the video. And I think it's a terrible movie because it first of all, that kind of precision really, maybe somewhere way in the future it might happen. And I think it was very simplistic. And it leads us to believe that there is sort of this this kind of future or a very bad one. I do agree with your book about the prevail scenario. Of course, we should be able to control and we should be able to think about what we're doing, but I want us to think about what we're doing right now in medical practice and because of so many decisions being made. And I want the bioethicists to start asking real questions instead of supporting the status quo, of saying, where is our genetic research going? Where are our reproductive technologies going? I want those questions to be asked on a general basis. It isn't that we shouldn't dream and that we shouldn't think about the future, but I think we also have to think about the immediate future.
We're talking about the future this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, with Joe Rothschild, author of The Dream of the Perfect Child, and Joel Garro, author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Erin in Ithaca. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Ira.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm calling in because my daughter, Maggie, has a very rare chromosomal disorder. We did not have in vitro testing, although it would not have shown up. And this has become a really personal issue to me because I think had we known during our pregnancy what her disabilities were going to be. She has a syndrome called Angelman syndrome. We probably would have aborted. And she contributes so much to the world. She has taught us so much. I think our humanity has been so enhanced. She's completely nonverbal, and so she's taught us how to listen, you know, in ways we never would have. Mm. And I just really wonder if we get to the point that people seem to want to get to of aborting children who aren't perfect, what that means for us in terms of how we accept difference, how we accept disability, and how we understand disability as being a fault that must always be corrected rather than something that's just part of being human, and that people with disabilities contribute to the world in so many ways and often force us to look at it differently than we would have otherwise.
Well, I just want to say to this young woman, you've read my book. Because that is very much my argument. Because when I started it, I didn't know where it was going to go. And doing the research on people with disabilities has really changed me. I think if I were 35 and pregnant and diagnosed with a particular kind of disability, I don't know. But the point is, now that I've done the research, I'd be much more conflicted. And I think that one of the things that's happened is that people with disabilities and their advocates have become much more vocal to talk about this. What we want to be able to do is put our energies to cure the syndrome that your daughter has, to be able to get to it. And there is a great deal of literature of the kind of thing of that you have experienced, too. As I say, I don't know what I would have done personally in this particular situation, but I think this is what we have to stop and think about. And, again, where we put our resources to do something about some of these conditions that we still have no cure or treatment for.
And the part that, to me, is so important is that we couldn't. First of all, we enjoyed our pregnancy and we enjoyed our daughter's infancy because we didn't know there was something wrong. And part of what makes it part of the human experience is that we didn't know. We couldn't plan for it. We couldn't, you know, and stuff happens, earthquakes, hurricanes, right? And that's part of disability, too, is that, you know, we can't control these things and maybe we're not supposed to be able to.
All right. Thank you for calling. Good luck to you. Have a good weekend.
Thank
you. 1-800-989-8255. So only about 30 seconds left. Joan, a lot of people will be making more choices now because of genetic screening.
Well, they may be making more choices, but I hope that they will be thinking about the choices and all of the people involved, the medical personnel, the pregnant women and their partners, and all of the other people in their family and in the human community will be trying to think about this in a different kind of way. That doesn't mean we're going to stop. I am not a Luddite. We are not going to stop the science or the technology, and I think it's fascinating, and I think it's remarkable. But I think we have to think.
All right, we're going to stop thinking because we've run out of time, not in the literal sense. Joel Garro is author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human, out this year from Doubleday. He's also a reporter and editor at the Washington Post in Washington. Joel, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Joan Rothschild, author of The Dream of the Perfect Child. She's also a professor emerita of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and a research associate at the Center for Human Environments at the Graduate Center in City University of New York. You're in New York. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Our program is produced, Kimberly Jones, let me tell you, is also our technical director, and our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music today, and we had help from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. Always surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can leave us email. Also, you can podcast Science Friday now and download our podcast, and you can also take it away on the Real Audio or on audible.com. And also the Science Friday Kids Connection is up there, where we've created free curricula for teachers. Just click on the Teachers button, and there it is, back editions of Science Friday that and this program today that you can bring into your classroom. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.